Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Live at the NYPL. My name is Nathaniel Rich. I'm the senior editor of the Paris Review. Norman Mailer was on this stage last and for the final time in public on June 27, 2007, in a Live from the NYPL event entitled The 20th Century on Trial. He shared the stage with Günter Grass and was interviewed by Andrew O'Hagan. The evening was presented by Harcourt, the International Center of Photography, the Goethe Institute, and the Paris Review. There's also a Paris Review connection to tonight's event, so I'm honored to introduce the leading Italian writer of our time, Umberto Eco. Eco's career, when people discuss Eco's career, there's a tendency to divide his work up into several discrete parts. There's the studies of semiotics, his essays on literature, on beauty, and on ugliness, his political, social, and cultural commentary, his television and radio appearances, his translations, and of course his five internationally best-selling novels, including most recently The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana. But what's so exciting to me personally about these novels is the way in which they encapsulate all his other interests and weave them together in subtle and often surprising ways. More than anything, however, his books work so well because he really knows how to tell a good story. In a forthcoming Paris Review interview, he reveals part of the secret to his prolific output in a quintessentially Ecoian way, if you can say that. He says, you know, since there's a lot of space between atom and atom and electron, if we reduce the matter of the universe by eliminating all the space in between, we should have the entire universe compressed into a ball. Our lives are full of empty spaces. I work, for instance, while waiting for the elevator. I can work in the water closet, in the train. I produce a lot of things while swimming, especially in the sea, less so in the bathtub, but there too. Before I introduce Mr. Eco, a few words about Live from the NYPL, which under Paul Holdengraber has become not only a vital and beloved fixture in the cultural life of New York, but also, in the words of the New York Times, a great single scene. Not an exact quote, but that was, I think, the meaning of the piece. Mr. Holdengraber has also commanded me to tell you that the mission of the library series is to make the lions roar. Sorry to do that. Eco will appear here on Saturday at 6 p.m. with Pierre Bayard, the author of How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read. And Monday the 19th, the library will welcome the great Dutch writer Cees Notenboom. The remaining tickets are being sold tonight. For tonight's event, the library thanks Harcourt and Rizzoli, as well as Metro Newspaper, the media sponsor for the Fall Live series, 192 Books, the bookseller partner. 192 Books is located on 192 10th Avenue. After the event tonight, Umberto Eco will be signing purchase copies of On Ugliness and Turning Back the Clock, Hot Wars and Media Populism. You enjoyed wine and cheese as you came in tonight. This comes to you care of Oriel. John Hunt, the president of Oriel, likes to quote Aristophanes, who said, quickly bring me a beaker of wine so that I may wet my mind and say something clever. John Hunt and his team will also help us capture the evening through video and podcast that will keep the conversation ongoing. Thanks to MTA's Arts for Transit, Music Under New York, and thanks tonight to the band Break of Reality. Consider becoming a friend of the NYPL and receive discounts off all future live tickets. After the conversation, Umberto Eco has agreed to answer a few questions. Please come up to the mic close to the entrance. I believe it's over there. It's now my honor to introduce Paul Holdengraber and one of my favorite authors, Umberto Eco.
Did you ever meet Norman Mailer?
Only once. We were waiting for an interview on TV. And he said, he told me, oh, my wife loves your books. And I missed the opportunity to answer, my wife too loves yours.
Well, we are here today to celebrate two books, On Ugliness and Turning Back the Clock, Hot Wars and Media Populism. Your two books have come out together in America at the same time, but they haven't been written simultaneously. No. I mean, you write in the bathtub, the tub in the ocean, okay. But they were not written simultaneously.
No, happily.
One was written...
No, the clock is a collection of articles written between 2000 and 2006. Okay, so... While the ugliness, yes, it has been concocted in the last 2 years.
Is there a connection, would you say, between these two books?
No connection, because they are so different, if not that they are of the same author. In order to make a joke, I could say that one is on ugliness, the second is on stupidity, but only in the sense that it concerns today politics.
But the book on stupidity, as it were, concerns politics, and the book on ugliness is kind of a history of ugliness. Let's begin, though, with the book on stupidity, because I am quite interested in the pieces you have in your book on Berlusconi.
Now, the case of Berlusconi concerns the stupidity of Italians, not of Berlusconi, who is very smart.
Right.
No, I have analyzed a technique of government, what I call a regime, which is media populism. Populism is a direct appeal to people by avoiding every mediation, the parliament, the Senate. In the old dictatorship, the leader had a direct relationship with the people, at least a representative part of the people. They were the 300,000-400,000 people in the Nuremberg Stadium or in Piazza Venezia, and there was that direct appeal. With the media populism, the people is invented by the leader speaking, because the people doesn't exist, is a virtual reality. But it can be very dangerous from the democratic point of view, because you avoid the parliamentary mediation. And what happened in Italy, and since little happened, that is the main political issues, and sometimes even judicial issues, who is the guilty one in this part, are decided in the talk shows before being discussed in the proper place. And that is an interesting feature of the media populism.
And dangerous because?
Dangerous because since people in itself is untouchable, unpredictable, the only way, statistical way, to know what the people think is to go to the election and to know that 50% are or 30%. In that case, well, as Churchill said, it is not the most perfect system in the world, but all the rest are worst. In the media populism, you have not this control, statistical control on people. You really... You say you people are approving what I am saying this moment, practically.
You do demonstrate in that book a certain interest in stupidity, and one of my very favorite lines on stupidity is by someone who was obsessed with it, and I'd like to have your reaction to this quotation. It is the way Flaubert felt about the 19th century, and I'm wondering if you feel somewhat in a similar way about the 21st century. Excuse my language as I read this. I feel against the stupidity of my time floods of hatred which choke me. Shit rises to my mouth as is a case of strangulated hernia. But I want to keep it, fix it, harden it. I want to concoct a paste with which I shall cover the 19th century. In the same way as the Indian pagodas were covered in cow dung.
You know, Flaubert was the great narrator of stupidity. Bouvard et Pécuchet is the great encyclopedia of stupidity. But even in the other novels, Monsieur Homais is in Madame Bovary. He was very sensitive. He was a great stupidity detector.
Right.
And so I admire. But my job is less heavy because...
Less heavy?
Yes, because we don't need a special detector to detect stupidity around you.
But do we need a detector then to detect ugliness?
No, ugliness is an elementary, in its most elementary form, is a sort of instinctive attitude. When it's the absolute ugliness is based upon disgust, repulsion, a rotten corpse, a rotten flower. That's, there is a sort, is the only case in which there is a sort of universal agreement about what is ugly, even though, you know, the Americans feel disgusting the fact that French eat frogs, and so you see that even disgust is not so so universal. And there is a beautiful page in Triste Tropique by Lévi-Strauss in which the bororo pick up from the trunk of a tree a sort of white fat worm, and they give it to him as the most delicious, and he's obliged to eat it. And step by step he says, okay, it looks like butter. But his first reaction is of disgust. Why? For the bororo, it was something gluttonous.
So ugliness is, can be relative. It's partly what you're saying.
Ugliness is relative to the ages and to the culture, like beauty. No. As a matter of fact, the two books I made were entitled History of Beauty and History of Ugliness. Then I don't understand why the English edition was on ugliness and not history of ugliness. It can be due to the hate of history that there is in this country.
Do you perceive there is a hate of history in this country?
Well, once one of the most important American philosophers wrote on the door of the Department of Philosophy, forbidden to the historians of philosophy. History has nothing to do with science. Anyway, that's why it was history of beauty and of ugliness, just because it's the history of a process, of a sequel of changing model.
Well, you know, in the American language, I don't know if in the English language it is the same, but in the American language, when you want to speak about something being irrelevant, you say that's history.
I told you.
Yeah. What fascinates me in stupidity, and then we'll move again back to ugliness, is another line of Flaubert. He said that when you begin analyzing stupidity, you really understand the concept of infinity.
Yes. We should return to that point because there is a strict connection between ugliness and infinity. But
Let's start with that.
I have prepared some images. Give me the first one. It was a man supposed to give the first image to start.
Well, we can analyze our logo if you'd like while we wait. It's quite.
Let's start with the first. No, it's not. If you don't give me the first...
Wait. If not, we can talk about it, but...
Well, I wanted to simply... Well, maybe it's there. It's there. It's okay. I want to show you three Venuses.
Now we have the first Venus.
Venuses. Well, this is a prehistoric Venus. This is a Renaissance German Venus, a little anorexic. That is a Rubensian Venus with some cellulitis. I would like to know with whom of them you would like to go to dinner this evening.
You know them better than I do.
I would like to go with that one.
Really?
But you see that there are...
Well, I feel similar there, in this particular case.
In these particular cases, if she leaves the animal at home... But I want, that is a typical case of relativity of beauty, and the same happens with ugliness. But now, that's another point.
But before we get to that, I'd like to ask you, why is it that you rather wrote a history of ugliness rather than a theory of ugliness?
Because since the concept is changing, it's very difficult to make a theory. The same holds for beauty, and on the contrary, there are many treatises on aesthetics in which people try to find at least certain features that are permanent in the aesthetic experience with success sometimes.
You seem to be hesitant.
With the ugliness, it was more difficult for two reasons. One is a practical reason. There were no theories of ugliness until the mid of the 19th century with the book of Rosencrantz on ugliness. Second, because while in beauty there is still always a sense of detachment, contemplation. The beauty of a flower is due to the fact that I don't desire to eat it. And if I contemplate the beauty of a human being, I don't want to have a sex affair with him or her when I contemplate the beauty. While in ugliness, there is also many aspects of passional participation. I made the example of a corpse, of a rotten flower. There is no detachment. You feel a sense of disgust. That's why it was very difficult to make a complete theory of beauty, as beauty was simply the opposite of beauty. Of ugliness, as ugliness was simply the opposite of beauty. It is the opposite of beauty plus something else. Plus something else. And, No, we went on that image who served to explain a problem. Why those two books have mainly works of art? They are not histories of art. But unfortunately, in order to know what in the past was considered beautiful or ugly, we have only works of art. It's only on our time that we have also other evidences, a poster, a photograph. And sometimes it's very difficult to distinguish between a work of art and the real representation of it. Suppose that an alien coming from the galaxies arrives here and see that, and he can believe that human beings today love this kind of woman. Then we bring him, her, it to a defilé, fashion defilé, he will discover that, on the contrary, we prefer that one. But in that case, we have the photograph of Naomi Campbell. For the past, we have only the works of art, and so we need then older documents. I mean, if we see in the past the representation of a being, and we have a document which says this is the devil, we can suppose that it is representing the ugliness of the devil. That's why both history of beauty and of ugliness are concerning only Western civilization. Because for other civilizations, sometimes we don't have or we are unable to find the accompanying documents. Take this African mask. Does it represent a devil, a god? Is it supposed to arouse laughter, fear, participation? We don't know. Besides, if a member of that society came for the first time in his life in the Western society and saw such a representation of Christ, no, there is something wrong again. Such a representation of Christ tortured, he would think that is only the representation of something radically ugly. While for a Christian, it inspires compassion, piety, affections, and so forth. So I was obliged to stick to the Western conceptions, because when you go in other civilization, the faces of the Easter Island are representing beautiful or ugly subjects.
you know this Latin phrase as well as I do, de gustibus non disputandum est, and I've, you know, that you cannot really, in French they say, de goût et de couleur on ne peut pas discuter, that taste is something relative, but and that we can't really debate it. But I have always found that the most interesting thing you and I can talk about is taste. And that people we get along with, even people we love, are people who share our adjectives. And there is an interest, as it were, in talking about taste. If we got rid of the notion of the relativity of taste between you and me, we would have very little to talk about.
Yes. In fact, the taste is a more complicated matter than the beauty and the ugliness. And it has been the subject matter of infinite treatises, philosophical treatises. I wouldn't like to touch the problem. But obviously, the variety of tastes are certainly linked to what are we calling the relativity of beauty and ugliness. However, an old colleague of mine called David Hume once wrote an essay, The Rule of Taste, and he quoted a story that appears in Don Quixote. There was a barrel of wine, and they were tasting the wine, and one said, it's good, but it has a certain iron flavor. And another one tasted it and said, no, it has a leather flavor. And finally, they emptied the barrel, and down there was a key with the leather, stick to together. So there was the variety of taste, but there is always possible to find objective elements that can justify sometimes different kind of taste responses.
Tell me, is there a natural sequence for you to have first written a book on the history of beauty and then write a book on the history of ugliness? Is it a sequel, part two, ugliness, part one, beauty?
No, it was a mere accident. I made the book on beauty because it was an old idea that I had 50 years ago that I was obliged to abandon it. So, at a certain moment, we made this book belonging to make a pleasant coffee table book. Okay. Then it was translated in 27 languages. And at that point, you know, publishers, they have also a dangerous penchant to profit. So my publisher said, we must do another book. And they said, there is no other book, because that book sold because of its title. We could have put inside even the phone book, it would have been the same. People wanted to buy History of Beauty to put it on their shelf in the same way in which they buy the Britannica Encyclopedia, and then they don't read it. But we will talk about that next on Saturday with Bayard. We will tell us how much he has not read the encyclopedia.
Right.
And suddenly, at a certain moment, there is something that can make a sort of good balance, ugliness, okay, and we start.
Which one aroused you more?
But listen,
the history of beauty or the history of ugliness?
I discovered just in doing the two books that beauty is terribly boring. Because it corresponds always, even through the variety of tastes, to a certain canon. Not to make it, that is a typical Greek statue, embody the canon of Polycletus. Because, let's see, a beautiful nose cannot be longer than that and cannot be shorter than that.
So there between is, this and this.
See, there is a limit. There is a limit. An ugly nose can be infinite. Can be as long
Cyrano
as
de Bergerac,
Cyrano,
Pinocchio,
the trunk of an elephant, the beak of an eagle, everything. So the variety of ugliness is infinite. You can find many forms of ugliness and always discovering something new. So ugliness is what is approaching us more to God at infinity than beauty. You have a variety of ugly. Again there.
Okay.
I told you that it doesn't work. I had my computer that was pretty.
No, but it's good. We get to see it again. And we never tire of ugliness. There.
I love this one too. Quentin Metzies, the most terrible representation of an ugly female. And I put it on the book with a text from the Anatomy of Melancholy of Burton. I was obliged to cut it because it was 3-4 pages long, and it was marvelous as a description of an incredible ugliness. If you want to read this,
yeah, I cut it too.
We don't have time. But it will be 10 times more.
It's longer than in what I'm reading, but it is an extraordinary text. It's Loving an Ugly Woman by Robert Burton in The Anatomy of Melancholy in 1621. Love is blind, as they say. Cupid's blind, and so are all his followers. Every lover admires his mistress, though she be very deformed of herself, ill-favored, wrinkled, pimpled, pale, red, yellow, tanned, tallow-faced, have a swollen, jugless, platter face, or a thin, lean, chitty face. I don't know what chitty face is myself. Have clouds in her face, be crooked, dry, bald, goggle-eyed, blear-eyed, or with staring eyes. She looks like a squid's cat, hold her head still, awry, heavy, dull, hollow-eyed, black or yellow about the eyes, or squint-eyed, sparrow-mouthed, Persian hook-nosed, have a sharp fox nose, a red nose, China flat great nose, snub a flat nose, a nose like a promontory, gubber-tushed, rotten teeth, black and even brown teeth, beetle-browed, a witch beards, her breath stink all over the room, her nose drop winter and summer, with a Bavarian poke under her chin, a sharp chin, lave-eared, with long crane's neck, which stands awry too, her dugs like two double jugs, or else no dugs in that other extreme, a vast virago of an ugly tit, a slug of fat, fusty lugs, didn't look that up either, a truss, a long, lean, raw bone, a skeleton, a sneaker, and to thy judgment looks like a mard in a lathorn, whom thou couldn't not fancy for a world, but hatest, loathest, as wouldest have spit in her face, or blow thy nose in her bosom. A cure for love, to another man, a dowdy, a slut, a scold, a nasty, rank, rammy, filthy, beastly queen, dishonest, peradventure, obscene, base, beggarly, rude, foolish, untaught, peevish. If he love her once, he admires her for all this. He takes no notice of any such errors or imperfections of body or mind. He had rather have her than any other woman in the world. I thought that Flaubert was provocative.
It seems that he was inspired by a text that a colleague of mine, a Latinist, promised me to show of Epicurus, or Lucretius, of Lucretius, in the Rerum Natura. So it's an eternal game.
Say more a little bit about this particular picture and why it inspires you so.
No, it's really beautiful. It's really beautiful. And when I was just finishing the book, I received a book published in Canada by Patricia Bettella on the ugly woman between Middle Ages and Baroque. A book that I had just time to quote in my own, and she had chosen that on the cover because it's really a sort of paramount example of and this is another problem, because from the antiquity they always said that art can represent beautifully ugliness, can represent ugliness beautifully. This is a case of a very beautiful representation of ugliness.
And when it's drawn in by the details, by the craftsmanship.
Yes. And the problem of representation of ugliness is, helps us to recognize that there are different kinds of ugliness. Let's call it the natural ugliness. This is the ugliest dog in the world. He won the contest last year. I found a photograph on internet. We have the absolute ugliness.
So you are looking on the internet for ugliness?
Yes, yes. First of all, in my library. In my library, I have only 50,000 volumes, but it was enough to find a lot of things. But internet with Google Image can help a lot.
It can help. It can help.
Asking ugly, and then I found this marvelous dog.
Ugly have many entries in Google, I imagine.
Yes, and then you can call it in English, in Italian, in French, in German, in Spanish, so you have many. But this is a case of absolute ugliness. Then before we saw a beautiful artistical representation of ugliness. Here, on the contrary, we have an ugly painting.
You think it's an ugly painting?
Absolutely ugly.
Ugly.
You know who was the author?
I think I might, but I'm just curious why you think this is an ugly painting.
No, maybe I am influenced by the author, but he's Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler, and it was a real chance that he shifted from art to politics, because otherwise it would have been a disaster for the history of art.
There is a theory that had he been admitted to the school, to the art school in Vienna, the world would have been quite different.
Certainly different. The rest of the world, the art would have suffered a little. But anyway, it's ugly. Okay, it's an ugly postal card. In fact, he did those things and sold them on the streets. And that is a case of artistic ugliness. But I want to show you this painting of the Ghirlandaio, which inspires us different reflections. First of all, is once again the artistically beautiful representation of an ugly face. Second, this face is not ugly in the sense of the ugly dog we had seen, which is totally ugly. This is a normal face with a little distortion.
I mean, just the protuberance
just an exaggerated protuberance. And don't believe that brown things on the forehead were part of that ugliness. They were a flow of the canvas, and it has been restored. And now at the Louvre, we don't have any longer that gray and brown part. But then we see that the boy is adoring this grandfather. And so we understand that there is a form of ugliness that can be nice, can inspire sympathy. It happens to Jerry Lewis. He's ugly, but enormously lovable and popular.
In France.
In France?
Yeah, Jerry Lewis is much more popular in France.
Yes, it happens sometimes. I want to open the parenthesis. I was asked in one of the recent interviews, and how do you explain the success of Barbara Streisand and of Gérard Depardieu? Both are ugly. And they said there is a third book to write, but I wouldn't be able to do that, and it is on charm. Charm is a mysterious quality that can depend, I don't know, from a glance, from a movement. You can be, you can have the nose of Barbara Streisand and to have a great charm. And so charm is a sort of category which is overlapping beautiful and ugly.
But you need that quality when you have such a nose.
Yes. And maybe you need such a nose when you have that quality, because
But say a little bit more about this, because we spoke about this image, and it is quite it takes you in.
No, because besides the boy is absolutely beautiful, so there is also this this confrontation between an adorable beauty and the beautiful nature
in the background.
And then the ugliness of the grandfather is probably due also to age, to sickness. It's not a structural ugliness, it's an accidental ugliness that came with time. So it inspires many, many interesting reflections.
Some of mortality, which we will come to later on.
Yes. Death is usually seen as ugly.
Let's talk a little bit about ugliness as it is lived by the person who feels him or herself to be ugly.
The story started very, very early because the Greek identified beauty with virtue and ugly with vice, but were obliged to accept the idea that Socrates was ugly, but he had a great
beautiful soul.
And Aesop was crippled, il bégayé, balbutiente, how do you say?
Stuttering,
hunchback. That was the absolute ugliness.
Like Quasimodo.
He was like Quasimodo, and he was a great moralist. But the compassion for ugliness starts with the Romanticism, with the essay on of Victor Hugo, the preface to Cromwell. The character who has a beautiful soul, but people doesn't recognize it and hate them because they are ugly. The Hunchback of Notre Dame, L'Homme qui rit, the Monster of Frankenstein. That there is a gallery of unhappy creatures that were condemned by their ugliness. Maybe the most touching text I found as a final one was the confession of Jean-Paul Sartre in Les Mots about the discovery he made in his childhood of his irremediable, absolute ugliness. And he has beautiful pages.
I'll read a small passage from it. You know, in French, do you know how you speak about that phenomenon of, how do you call it, when you're cross-eyed? You say, un œil qui dit merde à l'autre, one eye that says shit to the other.
Yes.
I will also only read a small passage. It comes from the words which Les Mots, which was his autobiography written in 1964. I am told that I am good-looking. I believe it. For some time, my right eye has had a white speck that will make me half-blind and wall-eyed, but this is not yet apparent. I had two reasons for respecting my teacher. He had my welfare at heart, and he had strong breasts. Grown-ups should be ugly, wrinkled, and unpleasant. When they took me in their arms, I didn't mind having to overcome a slight disgust. This was proof that virtue was not easy. There were simple, petty joys, running, jumping, eating cakes, and kissing my mother's soft, sweet-smelling skin. But I attached a higher value to the mixed bookish pleasure that I took in the company of middle-aged men. The repulsion which they made me feel was part of their prestige. I confused disgust with seriousness. I was pretentious. Other forms of... Did you want to add something?
No.
Other forms of representation of ugliness have to do with the representations of what we might call the enemy.
This is an eternal, because the one of the most instinctive feelings is the one who is different from us is ugly. So racism has this root. And then the enemy was always represented as ugly. We start with the Roman sculpture, in which the barbarians have a strange nose.
The nose is very important.
The
for
nose
ugly.
Is very for ugliness. Yes, sure. During the Reformation, the Catholic were representing Luther under the appearance of an animal, and the Protestant represented the Pope as a devil. So there was always in every war the enemy was represented as ugly, and the top was reached by the Nazi and fascist anti-Semitism. Even though I regret, we have not time to read the text of Richard Wagner, which is terrible.
The history of ugliness seen through. Let's see. I think maybe when you stop for a while.
It's turning the clock backwards.
Turning the clock backwards. We'll get to it. Here. There we are.
But this is a typical German representation of the ugly and evil a Jew, and this was a fascist during the Repubblica di Salò, which is this strange mixture. The Jew is American, but he has at the same time the red star, the Soviet red star on the jacket. So they put all together, American, Jews, and communists.
in Turning Back the Clock, you have an essay called Other Italians Anti-Semites.
Yes. Well, but it was, in general, an explanation of the fact that there was not so much real anti-Semitism in Italy, except the lunatic fringe of the Nazi. But there is another essay that was more preoccupied, of a colleague directing an international journal, where in the scientific committee were scientists, authors of all over the world, that in order to boycott the politics of Israel, she asked the two Israeli members to quit. Even though recognizing and admitting that they were critical of the Israeli politics, which is worse, so is a sort of racial identification. So it happens sometimes. That happened in the United Kingdom.
But are you saying then that...
But it has nothing to do with ugliness.
But are you saying that in Italy anti-Semitism is not a problem?
No, I don't think in this moment it's a problem. If you go through internet, it's a problem in the Arab world. It's not a serious problem. Also because the former fascists in this moment, they are for, in order to find again a sort of virginity, they are pro-Israeli. And so they are keeping down the last thrills of anti-Semitism of the old rank and file fascists. I think so.
Let's talk about beauty and ugliness in particular as it concerns the avant-garde. And I think the one image we've selected is, the first image at any rate, is extremely powerful because it's nearly unbearable to look at.
Yes. I published a text by Palazzeschi. So at the time he was a futurist, in which says we have to teach ugliness to our kids. And it's a text full of provocations about the most horrible things that one should teach their children. So the avant-garde at a certain point assumed ugliness as an element of provocation, not trying to transform ugliness into beauty, but to use the instrument of ugliness just in order to provoke disgust and
But ugliness, before you show it, ugliness as a tool for education.
But good, in the case we are showing that is which is the Chien Andalou of Buñuel, with that surgical operation in which they cut a human eye, there was not an educational purpose, but there was only the idea of provoking through a sort of surreal image. I told you that you had to use my computer.
No, the American computers are not working well.
Mine is Japanese. And, this, you know, with the 20th century avant-garde, there was a sort of art abandoned the idea of beauty. Not only to embrace the ideal of ugliness only, but they mixed it up. So the purpose of art was no longer, or not always, to realize something beautiful, but to realize something provocative that made us to reflect upon something that was producing a new kind of knowledge. A lot of things, but not necessarily beauty. Beauty went on the side of mass media more than or on the side of kitsch.
And kitsch is another part of your book on ugliness that I'm particularly interested in.
Yes, it's an embarrassing chapter because a lot of people would see the image we put there as an example of kitsch and to say, but they are beautiful. That's why they are kitschy.
But you have written about kitsch a long time ago.
A good definition of kitsch is something that which is not art but disguises itself as art, having on the contrary other purposes. So why were kitsch? So the paintings of Alma Tadema, which now is sold by Christie's for fortunes of billions. Dollars, but it remains kitsch because it beautiful represented naked odalisques in order to provoke also a sexual excitation. But it presented it like art. I want to explain you clearly what is kitsch and what is not. This is a publicity of the Folie Bergère, beginning of the 20th century. It's not kitsch. It's not art. It's good advertising. In order to advertise, in the limits allowed by the morality of the time, a beautiful dancer. Today she will be naked. At the time it was like that. But okay, it doesn't lie. It sells exactly what it promised. And then is what is considered an important Italian painter, Boldini. Boldini was making portraits of important ladies of his time. And he was obliged to represent them beautiful. But he was also obliged to show that his portrait was a work of art. So if you look on the lower part, he's an impressionist. He makes art. On the upper part, he makes pornography. He makes the woman desirable. That is a typical example of kitsch. He promises you art, but in fact he gives you something different. It's a case of beautiful kitsch, okay. He was an artist, so his own was a problem probably of honesty, because when he made male portraits like this well-known one of Montesquieu, he was very beautiful.
Do you agree with Hermann Brock's idea on kitsch, that kitsch actually, there's an ethical problem with kitsch?
But yes, because if I said that kitsch is an artistic lie, well, with the idea of kitsch, you are mixing up the ethical with the aesthetical problem. Then I have also another chapter on Kemp, but Kemp is another story.
What is
kitsch is a class problem, But I mean class not in the Marxian sense, in the economic sense, but in the intellectual sense, by which a millionaire can belong to the lower class from the intellectual point of view, and a poor student can be the upper, intellectually, the upper class. So Kitsch is something is beautiful for the lower class and is ugly for the upper class. Then there is an upper class which decide that the kitsch of the lower class is so kitschy that it becomes beautiful. That's is not me. Is the theory of Susan Sontag. Is beautiful because it's horrible.
Right. So that's an ironic stance towards kitsch.
It's an ironic stance, but it is linked to difference of class differences.
What is the tension between kitsch and then vulgarity?
There can be vulgarity which is no kitschy. A hardcore porn movie is enormously vulgar. It doesn't pretend to be a work of art. It gives you exactly what you want. So it's vulgar, but not kitschy.
Why is one of the places you've written about quite wonderfully is the Madonna Inn in California? Why we don't have an image of that, but
Madonna Inn is a kitsch for the lower class.
I stayed there once.
It's beautiful.
It really is. I enjoyed it enormously.
From a camp point of view, it's incredibly beautiful. Yes, it's like the Snow White dwarves in your garden.
Right.
Yes, Madonna Inn, go there. It's full of people in honeymoon. They want to have the first night in the Neanderthal room, German windmill,
the German
Egyptian tomb. That's marvelous.
There's an obsession and an interest in this kind of phenomenon in Europe for Las Vegas in that particular way.
Yes, but that produces with Venturi and order the new theory of postmodernism. What was originally kitsch has become something different.
I'm sorry to use this word again, but Milan Kundera has written very succinctly on kitsch. He said that kitsch is a denial of shit. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
I don't know. I don't remember that passage, I don't remember what is deny of shit. And so, deny of shit is a beautiful, sweet cake, no? With cream, peaches and cream from Mr. Sen.
We'll leave it there. I think as we move away from kitsch and to what we might call the relativity of beauty and the relativity of ugliness, it has become more and more difficult to make a real distinction, or an important distinction between beauty and ugliness.
Yes, and there are certain philosophers who say that not only the avant-garde art has deleted the difference between beautiful and ugly, but even in the everyday life, we are, I would use the term that I used also at the end of the history of beauty, we are living in a polytheistic regime. We have not a single god, but many different divinities. And so you can have the same girl who adores this man, who could be the subject matter for a Renaissance portrait, but she adores also that one. And I don't understand certain purpose. For me, it's ugly, but probably for her, it's beautiful. So she, I say she because but it can be also a gay adoring both. But probably they are equally exciting for young people,
and that this can create a sense of incertitude in people who want to create the standards of beauty.
Yes, not only, but I found a beautiful discovery. This is Jeronimus Bosch, and they are the persecutors of Christ. In order to represent them as evil and damned and ferocious, you see that they have piercing that probably at the time was typical of the pirates, of the criminals, until the 19th century, in which for Lombroso, the tattoos and all those kinds of piercing were the sign of moral and psychic deprivation. But today, this is a positive model, maybe a little exaggerated, but throw away some 20 rings and pins, and it becomes a positive element. So there were also the changes in taste. But I am not sure that we have lost the sense of ugliness, the difference with beauty. First of all, we still have it when going to movies. People want to George Clooney or Cameron Diaz. Second, when we watch the television and we see tortures, massacres, we still have the sense of a sort of fundamental, absolute ugliness, and that saves us.
But the attraction too.
The attraction for ugliness has been an eternal feeling. And Schiller wrote a beautiful essay by saying, but people has always loved ghosts. The Romans went to see the Christian devoured by lions. In the diary of Samuel Pepys, you see that he paid a lot to find for his wife a ticket to see the hanging in Pendaison. So the attraction for the horrible has been always the Elizabethan tragedy, even Shakespeare. So this is a permanent... To feel an attraction for the ugliness doesn't mean not to be able to recognize, to tell ugliness from beauty. And I can feel an attraction for the represented ugliness, but to feel a repulsion for the real ugliness. I can feel an attraction for a movie of Quentin Tarantino, but if you come to my place and you shoot to me, I don't feel any attraction. So we have still a sort of moral reaction.
So you're saying to me that you're fairly hopeful that these distinctions are being made.
I think that this lack of distinction is probably more an insistence of the media than a real situation.
There are your book is capaciously illustrated throughout. On ugliness, and nevertheless, you've left out some pictures that we saw together.
We left out hundreds of pictures and hundreds of anthological pieces. But the one I want to show, and I was obliged to leave them out because they were on internet, but without the name of the author and without the name of the source, it was even impossible to ask for rights.
And you say in your essay on serendipity that you console yourself with material you haven't included for future excursions in erudition.
But he or she or they, I don't know if they are different authors, took great master pieces of painting, I have here only a few of them, and they deformed them. It was a sort of uglification. It's Hannibal the Cannibal of Milo. The planet of the, with King Kong on the... Well, okay.
You may include this in the next edition.
Yes, but if we don't find the owner of the rights, it can then provoke...
Well, you know, as you came up with this term of uglification, I too, in the meantime, discovered my own a little series of uglifications, and I wanted to surprise you with a few images of uglification that were recently published in Vanity Fair, in the current issue of Vanity Fair, and we'll show those if we could. Now, in
it is not uglification. This is metamorphosis. Metamorphosis.
Because it's a changing from one to another. In turning back the clock, there is there's one essay that two essays that I really like enormously. One is called A Dream, and it's towards the end of.
Yes.
Do you want to say something about that essay?
No, because, well, it was simply due to a provocation. The Espresso asked many collaborators to tell of a dream.
And what was
that
dream?
I had a sort of tragic ecological dream in which all the technology had collapsed and we were living in a better world, but by knowing that is a pure utopia, therefore a dream.
You say in a hopeful moment in this dream, and I wonder if this dream for you holds some reality, you say reading will become popular again because, with the exception of fire, books can survive all kinds of disasters. They will be discovered in abandoned rooms and removed from the great ruined city libraries. They will be lent out and given as presents at Christmas, and they will keep us company in the long winter nights and in the summer as we answer nature's call beneath a tree.
Yeah. That is a reasonable dream.
Huh? And?
And I am interested in the realization of that dream, you know, as an author.
With 50,000 books.
With 50,000.
Are they all in one place, those books?
No, only 30,000 in my apartment in Milano and the other in other places.
How do you order them?
There is no order because they change place according to the interest of that moment. So a book that yesterday could be in the aesthetics shelf because I was working on ugliness, it can shift to the problems of translation in another shelf. So I remember the color. And a few times I get wrong with the color, I spend weeks and weeks in looking for that yellow book that in fact was green.
But in the meantime, you have discovered a lot of other books.
That is a subject matter for
Saturday.
Saturday night.
Another essay which I'd like to end with, quite naturally so, is an essay called On the Disadvantages and Advantages of Death. I take it that title was inspired to you by Nietzsche's essay on the advantages and disadvantages of history for life.
Yes, it is the second untimely
meditation.
Yes.
And in it you say the following. The philosopher acknowledges one painful disadvantage of death. The beauty of growing and maturing is in realizing that life is a marvelous accumulation of knowledge. If you are not stupid or chronically absent-minded, you learn more as you grow. We call this experience. In times gone by, the elders were considered the wisest of the tribe, and their task was to pass on their wisdom to their children and their grandchildren. It is a wonderful thing to know that every day you learn something more, that your past errors have made you wiser, and your mind, and that your mind, while your body perhaps gets weaker, is a library that grows larger every day with the addition of a new volume.
So and the disadvantage is that by dying, you lose this marvelous accumulation of wisdom. Even though you have left books, Plato left a lot of beautiful dialogues, but probably there were other ideas he had over kinds of consciousness he elaborated that got lost with his death.
Well, there's an African...
This is the main disadvantage. All the rest are advantages.
The only advantage is that your mind disappears.
Yes.
And all... And all the knowledge,
the knowledge you have elaborated. This is not enough to say, oh, there are the libraries, because there was a thrill you felt a night of April in face of the sea, and that was a kind of experience which has not transported in a book, which doesn't, and you have lost it. Okay.
There's an old African saying that goes like this: when an old wise man dies, a library disappears with him.
Well, that's that.
And you, in just about the last paragraph of the essay, you say, and then if wisdom consisted, as I said, in the growing conviction that I was living in a world of idiots, how?
That's fundamental. Yes.
Which part is fundamental?
To strongly believe that you live in a world of idiots. Because if at the moment of your death you think that the world is full of brilliant scientists, illuminated, enlightened politicians, you are very sad to abandon this world. But if you are sure that it's a world of idiots,
you're ready for death. So being ready for death is acknowledging that we're surrounded by stupidity.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, there is some consolation there. You say, and then if...
And everybody collaborates in creating this impression. Day by day. But not go too fast. The last revelation will be at the last moment. Until that moment, you should still believe that somebody is not so stupid. But at the moment of your death, no. You must reach this sort of certainty.
Illumination,
epiphany, yes.
But Festina lente. And you say, and I repeat, and then if wisdom consisted in the growing conviction that I was living in a world of idiots, how should I stand to survive as the only wise man? Being the only one with memories in a world of scatterbrains who have regressed to prehistoric levels, how could I bear my intellectual and moral solitude?
That's the one just of the advantages. Now, there are other two advantages that if immortality is granted for everybody, your family, your friends, that you will live in a world over populated of people extremely old, 300, 400 years old. That would be unlivable with absolute incomprehension between an old person of 500 years and a young man of 20. So, even the contrary, immortality is granted only to you. But what a solitude to have lost all the persons you loved, and to be obliged to live in a world of young people, the only Methuselah of the situation. And remark that after 1,000 years, you were loving, I don't know, the Goldberg variation, but after listening to them for 1,000 years, that's really exhausting. So you will hate Bach, you will hate Raphael. So it would be an impossible life.
What will you begin loving, do you think?
Hmm?
What will you begin loving? After hating Raphael, what will be the next?
I think it would be a complete torture. No, it's not life. Immortality is not life. It's not a way of living.
Thank you very much. There is a mic sort of in the middle there on the right-hand side. And if you could come up, Umberto Eco will take some questions.
Is it on? Yeah. When you showed...
Speak slowly, because when you are far, I risk to miss a certain...
I will. You showed one of your pictures... And you described it as there was a line between art and pornography. Could you talk about that a little more. Why does there have to be a line between art and pornography?
What?
Why does there need to be a line between art and pornography?
I said that the aesthetic experience usually implies detachment, absence of desire. Why good pornography requires the presence of desire, otherwise it's not pornography. It's not worth the money you spent for. So there is a precise line. Is something tries to arouse your sexual desire is pornography. If something can be contemplated without being disturbed by your passion is art.
You showed many artistic representations of both beauty and ugliness, and there are thousands or at least hundreds of museums in the world devoted to these artistic representations, particularly of beauty and the beautiful ugliness. But as far as I know, there's only one museum devoted to actual ugliness, which is the Museum of Bad Art, which is in Boston. I don't know if you've been to see it.
No.
And I'm wondering whether you think that there should be more of an appreciation of true ugliness, not beautified ugliness.
Yes, yes. It can be interesting also from a camp point of view. And it can be educationally useful in order to teach young people what is the difference between beauty and ugly in art. It can also be a sort of sadistic experience. So I don't know the museum, so I don't know in what they have really selected or not, but you gave me a useful suggestion next time in Boston I go there.
But you think that it is important for young people and for all people to read bad books in order to appreciate good ones?
Not to read the bad books, but I think that the critical education consists in saying, look, this page of Flaubert is very beautiful because it does so, so, and so. This one of Feuilleton is not so beautiful because it's repetitious. A comparison between different styles can be educationally useful. Yeah? I mean, in the same way, a surgeon shows to their students a normal liver and a sick liver in order to show the difference between health and sickness.
Hmm? Hi. You said ugliness is not just the absence of beauty, it's the opposite of beauty plus something else. I was wondering if you think Times Square has that something else.
Well, is no longer so beautiful as it was 20 years ago. Obviously, because it had the beauty of disorder, vice, perversion. Now it seems to me too much a Walt Disney, yes. But I must admit that since it's no longer the one I knew, I go very seldom to Times Square.
But all these flickering and random bombardment by information, doesn't it disgust you?
But so you are not speaking of the Times Square of porno sites of 20 years ago, but of the ensemble of Broadway and, you know, is. Would you say that fireworks are vulgar? No. They're obviously not a great work of art, but when used for festivities, they are not vulgar. And so I think the typical lights and flickering of that area is a sort of fireworks. Then if you want to see something else, go to the MoMA. So.
Thank you.